present things, but it doesn't mean they're not real. The new Jerusalem coming out of heaven means that heaven and earth are united in the eternal state. There's no division between what we call earth now and the dwelling place of God, heaven. It's the same place. That's not true right now. We live on earth, and yes, God is everywhere, but there's a sense in which his glory is only fully revealed in the heaven where he dwells. That's not going to be true anymore in the new heavens and the new earth. And so Jerusalem descending out of heaven lets us know that existence is going to be very different there. And the great difference is going to be that God dwells with us. Ever since the Garden of Eden, there has been a separation between us and God. And only very rarely have man been invited to come into the direct presence of God. That's not going to be true in the eternal state. We're going to dwell with him. And so this holy city descending out of heaven represents that. But is the city real? Yes, it is. We're going to see how real it is in just a little bit when John and an angel go about measuring the city. And he makes a great statement for us that this angel has a measuring stick in his hand. And John says he measures it. Oh, and by the way, it's the measurement of a man, which is the same measurement angels use. Isn't that an interesting statement? You know, we wonder a lot about angels and what they're like and what their reality is, but apparently they use definitive measurements just like we do. And I'm sure they use the English system and not the metric system. I'm positive of that fact. Actually, I don't think they use either one of them, but okay. So this city is descending out of heaven. So John pictures this. He's standing on this mountain and he's watching this city descend out of heaven and rest upon the earth. And he notes for us that it has the glory of God. That glory, that radiance, that brilliance is hard for our words to put into description. But this city radiates it in every way. The reason for that is going to be seen because God is there. All of his glory fully revealed in this new city and in a way that is not true on this earth. We see the glory of God around us. We see his handiwork. We see the things that he's made here. But in the new Jerusalem, we will see him. And that's a very big distinction. This entire city totally reflects and radiates the glory of God, and every inch of it is designed to display his beauty. It has the glory of God. It's radiance like a most rare jewel. John uses a word there that most rare is very good translation of. We have precious jewels. We have semi-precious jewels. We have precious metals, semi-precious metals. You know, gold's more valuable than silver. Silver's more valuable than brass. We're talking about gems of the highest quality. Even our diamonds, you know, we have rating systems for them. Is it a pure diamond? Is it a big diamond? How is it cut? What does it look like? How well does it reflect light? So John's telling us these gems that are used here, though some of them vary even on our scale of value, you know, jasper stone's not quite worth in our world what an emerald is, but he's telling us these are the supreme examples of every one of these stones. They're beautiful. They're most rare. They're exceedingly valuable. There's going to be something quite unlike our earthly stones in these new ones. But there's also going to be some similarity because we can identify them and know them. So this city is like a jasper. It's clear as crystal. It means it's highly polished. It's reflective. That's going to be important when we talk about the glory of God shining through and radiating through this city, is that everything about its construction is designed to radiate God's own glory. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the 12 gates, 12 angels, and on the gates, the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. On the east, 3 gates, on the north, 3 gates, on the south, 3 gates, and on the west, 3 gates. It's great and high walls, and even though in the new heavens and the new earth, there will be no sin, therefore there will be no danger. And yet this city has these walls to display the fact that it's impenetrable. It's protected. By the power of God, and John's going to make a statement later on in the chapter, nothing unclean, nothing detestable will ever enter that city. And those gates are sort of a demonstration that God is going to protect this new heavens and a new earth in a very special way. God created this heavens and earth too, didn't he? And by his sovereign plan, sin came into this world to display his glory in mercy as well as to display his glory in judgment. There will be no rebellion in the new heavens and new earth. I think this is important because it helps us understand. There's an idea out there about called the circle of time. Things just keep repeating themselves. You know, aeon after aeon, things happen and rehappen and rehappen. That is not true. God allowed the fall of this world into sin. He's going to judge that sin so that his mighty justice can be displayed. But once the new heavens and the new earth begin, there will be no sin ever again. Those great high walls of that city display that protection. So, are the walls kind of symbolic? Yes, they are. Does that mean they're not real? No, they're very real. There will be actual walls around this city because he tells us they're there and he's going to measure them for us. But it lets us know that this new heavens and new earth is protected. In God's plan, never any more sin. The cycle won't repeat itself. God did it once. The great high walls, 12 gates. Interesting tidbits here about these gates. And he tells us that gates are distributed. There's three on the north side of the city. There's three on the east. There's three on the south. There's three on the west. They have the names of the sons of Israel inscribed upon them. We're going to see some interesting things here about the makeup of this city and I think what that represents to us. Again, are the gates real? Yes. Are they literally going to have the names of the sons of Israel inscribed on them? Yeah, because it is through Abraham and his seed that all the nations of the earth will be blessed, and that promise is going to be memorialized forever in this new Jerusalem. It is through Israel that Jesus Christ came. And it's through Israel that we are all then blessed by the Messiah and saved. And so Israel is an important part in God's plan, especially in the history of this world, and that'll be forever memorialized in the new world. Now we can speculate a little bit, and I'll just say this is speculation because I want to make a pretty good distinction there. The text doesn't say this. But I draw a connection between the fact that while Israel was wandering about in the wilderness, God directed them to set up their camp in a specific way. The tabernacle was at the middle. And around it, on each side, three tribes camped on the north, three on the east, three on the south, three on the west. And I just wonder if there's a similar setup in the new heavens and the new earth whereby the redeemed Israel camps around the city according to their tribes. And that's why those gates are set up that way. Once again, that's a speculation on my part. I'm not saying that that's precisely what this text says. It does tell us there's 12 gates, one for each tribe of Israel. But I just wonder if that pattern given to us in the Old Testament while Israel was wandering through the wilderness is indicative that that's how things are going to be in the eternal state. But there's another interesting thing other than the gates. Verse 14, the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So we have gates named after the tribes of Israel. We have foundation stones named after the apostles. And in that, those two designations, we've got this wonderful representation of the unity of God's people. In the history of this world, there's a distinction between what God is doing through the church and what God is doing through Israel. God will fulfill all of his promises to Israel just as he gave them. The church is not the recipient of the promises of the land. Okay? God will give them that land. We have different promises. They have different promises. Our purposes, God's purposes for Israel are different than his purposes for the church. But when it comes to the new heavens and the new earth, all of those people are united and that division's totally erased. I don't say we'll ever forget it because it's going to be memorialized in the stones and on the gates. But we'll recognize that once we come to rest in the eternal state, those purposes have been fulfilled. The new heavens and the new earth, God's people will dwell together in perfect unity. and that his plan of salvation accomplished through Israel and accomplished through the church is going to be something we'll remember forever because it's memorialized in the very construction of the city in which we'll live. Verse 15, the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. Well, even that right there tells you how wonderful this place is going to be. Anybody have a measuring tape made out of gold? I don't either. I mean, mine are all plastic or aluminum or something not quite as valuable. But he has this measuring rod, the angel. And this is not a unique thing in prophecy. Ezekiel chapters 40 and following, Ezekiel accompanies an angel who goes around and measures the temple. And he measures all the courts around the temple. And it's an interesting study because the measurements he gives don't match any of the temples that we know of. They don't match Solomon's temple. They don't match the tabernacle. They don't match Zerubbabel's temple. They don't match Herod's temple. So a lot of the scholars debate about what was Ezekiel's temple. Is it the millennial temple or is it some other temple that we don't know about yet? But that's just to show this idea of going around and measuring things in prophetic visions is not unique. In fact, earlier in the book of Revelation, we saw an angel go about and measure the earthly temple during the tribulation period. And it was a sign that God had set that temple off as a specific for a specific purpose during the tribulation. For the first 3.5 years, the Jewish people were allowed by Antichrist to continue to worship there. And then, of course, in the middle of it, he cut off that access and declared himself to be God. But John and this angel go about and they measure the city of New Jerusalem. The city lies four square, its length the same as its width. And he measured the city with his rod 12,000 stadia. Its length and width and height are equal. Now, we need a little bit of perspective on this to get an idea of just how big this city is. If this city were built on our current earth, here's its footprint. 12,000 stadia works out to be just under 1,400 miles. 1,400 miles in a square. That's big. That's very big. In fact, that wouldn't fit on this present earth unless you planted it in the middle of Asia or something like that. But it's big. But remember again, he's not putting it on this earth. He's putting it on a new earth. What does that tell us? I don't know. Could it be that the new earth is going to be much, much, much bigger than this one? There is a lot God doesn't tell us, that we can only speculate about the new heavens and the new earth. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know how big it's going to be. We don't know how its physics operate. God has not told us. Does gravity work the same there? Does light work the same there? Do physics work the same there? Gary's going to have to redesign all of his mowers, I think, just to get them to work. It's going to be a wonderful place, but we don't know an awful lot about it. And just this description lets us know this thing is so otherworldly that it's hard to comprehend because this city is that big. Not only does it lie four square, John tells us in verse 16, its height is the same as its width. Now, that doesn't mean the city is a perfect cube, but it does mean that the buildings in the city, at least some of them, stretch up to that height. Now, on what earthly city can we have buildings stretching up to 1,400 miles tall? It can't be done, not by any engineering that we know of. That leads us again to question, what's this new earth going to be like? Now, granted, today we have to deal with the effects of sin in our building construction, so we have to deal with things like uncontrolled from our perspective, winds. Nothing's ever outside of God's control. What about earthquakes? Is the new earth going to have to deal with earthquakes? No. No, it's certainly not. Is the new earth going to be flat or round? Is it spherical like our present earth, or is it just a big flat thing hanging out in space? You know, God doesn't tell us. It's hard to imagine how you could have a flat foundation on something this large. Of course, I guess he doesn't tell us the foundation is flat. Maybe it's curved to perfectly match the shape of that planet, but we don't know. But this gives us an idea of the scope of this new city. And it's not crazy to think that it has to be this big. How many redeemed are there throughout the ages of the world? Now we know Jesus tells us that the way is broad that leads to destruction, and the way that leads to life is narrow. Few there be that find it. But we also know the descriptions that how many were gathered around the throne earlier in the chapters of Revelation. It was a multitude without number. People from every nation and tribe and tongue gathered there will dwell in this city. And Jesus is preparing a place for each one of them. What's that going to look like? How many square feet do we each get? I'm pretty sure we're not going to be just like this for eternity. It's going to be spacious, it's going to be beautiful, it's going to be restful, it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful place, but it's going to be big. 1,200 stadia, sorry, 1,400, 12,000 stadia in dimensions. He also, verse 17, he also measured its wall. Here again, the reason why I say these things are real. The city is going to exist very literally because he measures it. And the wall is going to exist. He tells us it's 144 cubits by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement. Now, cubit traditionally has been defined as the distance from the elbow to the fingertips. Now, some of you, that's bigger. Some of you, that's smaller. But there was a standard cubit measurement that was accepted, and most people fell pretty close to that range. Does this tell us that angels are just about the same size as people? Yeah, maybe. They at least use a similar measuring tool, right? 144 cubits is, 216 feet. Walls that are 216 feet. That's big. That's very big. Once again, I do believe these are real walls. They're going to be there. Why are they going to be there? To demonstrate to us just how secure God's new city and new creation are from anything threatening or anything that could destroy. Nothing will enter the city that can harm it. Now he also tells us, he gets into this wonderful description in the following few verses about what this place is going to look like, as he describes the gemstones out of which this thing is built. Verse 18, the wall is built of jasper. So I've tried to find some pictures of these various gemstones. Not being much of a, is it gemnologist? I have not much knowledge of gems. I'm not a gemnologist, right? So here's a picture of a jasper stone, both an unpolished one and a polished one. It's a rock. It's made up of various minerals, but it can take just about any color. They can find blue ones, green ones, yellow ones, red ones, as the picture shows here, but one of the great qualities of the jasper is how highly they can be polished and just how beautiful they are when they are polished. And so imagine when they're polished, as John says, because they're like crystal shining, perfectly smooth, reflecting every little bit of light and their own beautiful inherent color. This is the color of the city walls. This is what protects the city. Look at what's inside. The different foundations. Verse 18, inside the city was pure gold, like clear glass. Once again, highly, highly polished. Gold that's so smooth and so polished, it reflects everything. You know, I wear like the one little bit of gold I have, my wedding ring, and it's been beat up over the years. I'm not easy on these things. And it doesn't reflect the way it did when we bought it. Can't see my face in it. Scratches. Nicks, it's bent. But there in the heavenly Jerusalem, all of the streets, all of the stuff paved with gold, what we consider to be a precious and valuable commodity here on this earth is going to be used to pave the streets. Nobody collects asphalt and says, wow, look at how gorgeous that is. Cement is too abundant. It's not worth anything. When we don't need it anymore, we pile it up just south of town here. But this is the jasper stone. He tells us, verse 8:19, he's going to go through the list of the stones making up the foundation. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. The first was a jasper, which we see here. The second, a sapphire, a clear stone of brilliant blue hues that can also be polished and cut. Very hard material, sort of like diamond. So the second's a sapphire, the third an agate. Now he's not necessarily telling us that each foundation is one of these stones, but that these are the stones used to adorn the city. All over the place in the New Jerusalem, we're going to find stones of the highest quality of these examples. Some of your translations may call this one chalcedony. There's actually a town in Turkey named after this stone. And we have an important church council that met there, the Council of Chalcedon, in the 5th century. But can, again, be polished. The hues in it are beautiful because of the different minerals that are making it up. The next one he mentions is an emerald. The fourth, an emerald. Beautiful green stone. Again, with the unpolished and the polished next to each other in the pictures there. The fifth is an onyx stone, which once again comes in many different colors. We see black ones there and red ones. The sixth, a carnelian. Deep red stone. The seventh, called a chrysolite, also I think called a yellow topaz, got a beautiful green hue to it. That one's not polished, but it could be. The eighth, beryl, a clear stone with a slightly white haze to it. The ninth, a topaz, which again comes in many different colors. The tenth, a chrysophase. A layered rock, once you polish it up, very beautiful stone with the different swirls and things that go into it. The 11th, a jacinth, that deep red stone there, not the part on the bottom. And the 12th, an amethyst, nice purple color. These are the stones that make up the city. The city is adorned with all of these things. What we consider the most precious and valuable minerals in this world are going to be used as decorations in the world to come. What does that tell us about the place? It's just going to be beautiful. And imagine the glory of God shining throughout the city, hitting each of those stones and reflecting itself through them. It was always kind of fun when I was in college at Appalachian. We would go into the chapel and it had this interesting, unique lighting there, and you could see all of the engaged girls sitting with their rings, turning it this way and that, and watching it, the diamonds sparkle. My poor wife had to look awfully closely to see the diamonds sparkle. But part of what we value about these stones is the way they reflect and diffuse light. And imagine the glory of God, that pure, unapproachable light that Timothy talks about, being radiated throughout the entire city and reflected on every wall by all of these various gemstones, beautiful ones, pure ones, polished ones. It's going to be a beautiful place. Our words fail us to try to describe it now. But this is the New Jerusalem that God is creating for us. Verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl. Anybody own a pearl that size? I want to see, how big is the oyster that this thing came out of? All right, that's a monster. But a pearl large enough to serve as a city gate. It's like the giant trees out west, those sequoias through which we cut roadways. But to have a pearl big enough that you can cut a roadway through it and put a gate in it, that people can enter the city through this pearl. It's huge. The street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. Now he notices an interesting thing missing in verse 22. This will be the second thing that he tells us is not in the New Jerusalem. The first thing that he told us isn't in the new heavens and the new earth is there's no sea. There's no ocean there. Now, whether there's going to be lakes, probably. We do know there's going to be at least one river. But there's no ocean. Verse 22, I saw no temple in the city. Now, this in itself is totally unlike anything we construct in this world. Almost every city in the history of this world has had some temple in it. Almost everyone. Because mankind throughout his history has recognized that he was made to worship. Unfortunately, most of the time that takes the form of idol worship. They worshiped gods of their own making, but even that demonstrates the fact that we were created as beings who are meant to worship. And so everywhere we dwell in community, we create communal places to come together and worship. We do that with church buildings. Others have done it with other religious places. Every city in human civilization has had a place of corporate worship. It was also a recognition not only that we're supposed to come together to worship in corporate body, but also that this world was somewhat distinct and separate from the heavenly realm. Whatever God you were worshiping, he only dwelt in a certain place, and you had to go there to meet him. Of course, the Israelites recognize God dwells everywhere. They constantly reference things like this in the writings of the Old Testament. They knew that God was unlike the gods of the nations. And yet they also knew that going to the temple was going to meet God in a way that was different from our daily experience, because heaven and earth were separate places. The New Testament starts to tell us of some different things in John 4. Not that the New Testament's correcting the old, but it tells us about a new reality that's coming. John 4, 23 and 24, as Jesus is speaking to the woman at the well, he says, "The hour is coming and now is here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." And that, in answer to her question of, well, where should we worship? In Jerusalem or here at Samaria? And his answer was, the hour is coming when that won't matter. We realize that somewhat now in the church age, when we know that the Holy Spirit dwells within us, so that wherever God's people come together is an appropriate place to worship. That's why throughout history, when the saints have been denied the opportunity to meet in a church building, they gathered out in the fields. Because they knew wherever they were, they could meet with God and worship him as a corporate body. Now, it doesn't mean there isn't some convenience to having a church building. We've done this for centuries. But do you come to church? Do you know what the word church means? It means the assembled ones. You by yourself are not the church. Now, sometimes I hear this in songs, you know, that you are the church. Well, individually we're not the church, because the word means an assembled body, a group of people. But we are the church whenever we meet, wherever we meet. This is not the church. This floor, that ceiling, that's not the church. This is the church. In the new heavens and the new earth, there's no temple. There's no designated place for gathered worship. Why? Because our very existence is going to be about worship. I don't think that means we're not going to gather. In fact, there's some evidence in some of the prophets that talk about us gathering together for specific times of worship in the new heavens and new earth. But there is no temple there, because the entire realm is God's temple. Our entire existence will be in the presence of God. So there's no temple there. So there's no sea, there's no temple. For the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of the sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. So there's an interesting statement that he says we have no need of the sun or moon or stars. Now I want you to notice it doesn't say that there are not sun or moon. It says we don't need them. Whether or not there are a sun and a moon, he doesn't tell us. So is the earth going to have a day-night cycle? Well, there's not going to be nighttime there. He tells us that specifically. But the reason he says we're not going to have any night and that we don't have a need of the sun and the moon is because the glory of God shines everywhere. Once again, radiated throughout the city and reflected in every piece of construction, the glory of God is going to be the literal light of the world. In fact, he tells us it's not just going to be in the city. The glory of God gives it light. Its lamp is the Lamb, verse 24. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. God himself will serve as the light source of the new heavens and the new earth. When God created this world, he created the sun, the moon, and the stars to serve as lights, to serve as signs for times and days and for years. And those things are not going to be necessary in the new heavens and the new earth. We don't know if there will be stars there. We don't know if there will be galaxies or other planets. He doesn't tell us. He just tells us we won't need them. Interesting note as well, as he's talking here, he says, by the light of God, the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and the nations will walk in his light. Well, what does that tell you? A little bit about the governmental construction of the new earth. There's nations there. There's kings. There's an authority structure that's going to exist even in the new earth. We're going to be grouped together according to nations. I can't wait to live in a totally, completely redeemed America. Anybody longing for that right now? Keep praying for revival, by the way. I know sometimes we look at the things going on around us and say, oh, this has got to be the end. We must be getting close. There's no guarantee of that anyway, one way or the other. And it doesn't matter what all the talking heads on TV say. Nobody can fully predict what's going to happen. The history of the world is one of the ebbs and flows of political things. We don't know which way things are going to turn. So don't despair. God is still in control. But even if things do go badly, according to our estimation of them, is God still in control? Yes, he is. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and sets over them whomsoever he will. So yes, go out and vote next year. That's going to be an important part of our participation in this society as redeemed people. But if it doesn't go the way you want, don't despair. It's not over. Even if America falls, is it over? What's coming? A new heavens and a new earth where there dwells righteousness. Right? There will be kings, there will be nations, and it says they're going to bring their glory into it. That's a reference to the production, the things that the nations make. I might be taking a couple of steps into implicitness here rather than explicitness. But if there are individual nations and they are making things and bringing them into the New Jerusalem to adorn the new city, does that mean that there's going to be somewhat some cultural distinctives that continue to exist in the new heavens and the new earth? That one nation makes things that other nations don't, just like we have on the earth today. We still collect treasures from around the world. Museums collect them and say, well, this was made by a certain dynasty of somewhere. And they're interesting to look at because they're unlike things that we have. And I just wonder, does that mean that that's what the new heavens are going to be like? Nations existing, living forever, creating things that are unique. Creating things that are unique in a kind of a cultural way. Again, just an extrapolation there. Verse 25, its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. So when are the gates going to shut? Never. These gates are always open. They're guarded. We have angels on them. We have a high wall you have to pass through, but they're never shut. Why? Because there's no threat to this new city. The new heavens and new earth so filled with righteousness that there's no threat. So the city is never shut because there is no night. Now that does tell us that there's not a day-night cycle as we know it now. We're going to have a reference here in just a few verses to months. So it tells us there is a time cycle going. We're not going to exist in an eternal timeless state. There's going to be a measure of time somehow. Again, does that mean we have a moon? Does that mean we have a sun to mark off years, to mark off months, to mark off weeks? Not sure. Interesting to think about, though, isn't it? But we do know there will be no night. Verse 26, they'll bring into the glory and honor of the nations. Once again, that reference to the material produce of the nations. But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Why? Because nobody makes it into the eternal state unless God himself has brought them there. Before this world was created, God knew the number of names. He knew the total number of those whom he had chosen. And he will bring them each. He will bring them to faith in Christ. He will save them. And for eternity, we will dwell with him. Nothing can ever enter there that is detestable or false. The description of the new Jerusalem continues here for just a couple more verses, even though we have a division in the chapters. The angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. This gets referenced in several of our hymns that we sang about heaven, of that, shall we gather at the river? It's talking about this river. And once again, it's not really heaven, it's talking about the New Jerusalem. And again, that's not a point that is, you know, super, super important as far as theology goes, but it's a fun distinction for us to remember. There's a river flowing out of the throne of God. It goes down the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river, the tree of life with 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. There's that reference to time, the month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So this river flowing out from the throne of God waters this entire creation, but it specifically waters the tree of life. 12 trees, or a tree that yields 12 fruits, one each month. What is going on there? Well, back in the beginning of this world, God created two specific trees in the middle of the Garden of Eden. One was the tree of life, the other was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We picked the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and God cut us off from the tree of life. With a specific statement, God put an angel to guard the way of Eden, and he said, lest they extend their hand and take from the tree of life and eat and live forever. We were denied that eternal life. Now, sometimes I think maybe we get it in our minds that sin has corrupted the world, and hear me out on this whole thing here, because sin has corrupted the world, but that it's a force working and God is somehow like striving to just hold everything together so that sin doesn't completely destroy it. So it's like this force of sin and death and destruction is working, and God is just scrambling to try to keep it from totally destroying everything he made. That's a false image. Colossians chapter 1 talks about our Lord Jesus and tells us that we have been transferred into the kingdom of light, transferred out of the kingdom of darkness by his dear Son, that dear Son is the firstborn of all creation, and that by him all things consist, meaning are held together. And it doesn't mean that, you know, the forces of sin are trying to destroy things and Jesus is holding them together. It means that he is the one administrating everything. Why is it that we can study physics with such precision? Because Christ administers things faithfully. He always does it the same. From the largest span of galaxies in the universe swirling around each other all the way down to the minutiae of subatomic particles that we're just beginning to break apart. Christ holds all things together, which means that the judgment on this world, the death and the destruction that we observe, are an active judgment on his part because of our sin. He is currently administering this world in a way that it continually dies. So do we. That's the curse. In the sweat of our brow we'll eat bread, and pain will bring forth children. And all of the other aspects that God pronounced upon us because of our rebellion. Well, when he tells us that in this new Jerusalem, there's a river flowing out, watering the earth, that is a river of life, it means that his administration of the new heavens and new earth is different. It's no longer judgment. It's now a continual supply of life, of nourishment, of refreshing. That river is real. It will be there, but it does symbolize this, that there will be a constant flow of life from God himself. We don't possess life intrinsically. We don't possess existence intrinsically. God alone is the necessary one. He alone exists because he must exist. That's why he's called the I Am. We exist because he created us. Because he sustains us. And in the new heavens and new earth, there will be that continual flow of life. And it's symbolized by the river and those trees. The 12 kinds of fruit healing the nations. Well, this is a new heavens and a new earth. Those nations will never be harmed or destroyed by our sin or by our wars the way that they are now. But those trees constantly bearing fruit each month are going to be that visible display that God is continually refreshing the world, pouring his life and existence into it, so that there will never be death. There will never be destruction. Verse 3, no longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. Night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. There will be no end to the eternal life that awaits us in the New Jerusalem. Folks, that ought to encourage us. Whatever you've got going on right today, and what God's committed to your care is different than what he's committed to my care, is different than what he's committed to your care over here. Be faithful at it. The reward awaits us. And imagine this. God saves us by his grace. He empowers us by his grace. We don't deserve any of this. We deserve the lake of fire. We deserve eternal death. And yet God in his goodness reaches down, he saves us by his grace, and then he says, I'm going to empower you to serve me, and then I'm going to reward you for it. None of that started with us. The reward that he gives us is not because we earn it and because we do so well at our job. The reward he gives us is because he is good. And that ought to help us keep even more with our eyes on the ball, to fixate on that eternal purpose and that eternal reward, and to say, Lord, I want to serve you faithfully. Until you bring these things to pass, I want to serve you faithfully. We're going to close off our time with another great hymn about heaven. 697 in your hymnals, if you want to turn there. A lot of great things in heaven. In the eternal state especially, a lot of great things. The gems that we've studied about, the gold paving the streets, the wonderful brilliance of the glory of God everywhere, but the greatest thing about all of it will be that he's there with us and that we will dwell with him forever and ever.